Hello, welcome to Growing Wild. I'm Charlotte Pitts and this is Radio Reverb on 97.2 FM, online and on DAB radio. On today's show, we have got the wonderful project called Pedal People. We'll be speaking to the captain, Ellie Hargreave. We're going to hear from Joe, who's from the wellbeing project called Grow. And then finally, Rowena Garrett from Rowan Tree Coaching. First of all, we're going to have a song, and I've rediscovered Green Day. So this is Good Riddance, Time of Your Life.
So take the photographs and still frames in your mind, hanging on a shelf in good health and good time. Tattoos and memories and dead skin on trial. For what it's worth, it was worth all the while. It's something unpredictable, but in the end it's right. I hope you had the time of your life.
Brings back a bit of teenage angst, that, doesn't it? Ooh, the memories. Okay, so first of all, we have a project called Pedal People. Anyone that lives in Brighton may have seen these guys around. They have big red bikes and they call them pilots, the people that that cycle them, ride them, maybe would be a better term. And they cycle around older people in the community. But Ellie will describe that better, Ellie Hargreave, who is the captain of this project. They've been going for a couple of years now, and I can't believe that I didn't get them on earlier than this. It's such a great project. So here is Ellie. She had a bit of a cold, a bit of a chesty cold. The line sometimes is a little bit sketched. But here is Ellie telling us a bit more about this project.
So Pedal People is a small local charity in Brighton. And we run weekly cycling adventures for elders who live in care homes, and the majority of whom are living with dementia.
Okay, so what do the bikes look like then? How does that work?
Well, they're very big and red, so lots of people will be familiar with them on the seafront. They are basically a reverse rickshaw, so instead of the passengers being at the back, they're at the front. And this means they're right out on the front, which means they get all the interaction with people, children, dogs, passers-by, which brings them literally back into the community, into sight, and it means that they get the interaction. The pilot sits up on the bike behind, and they also get plenty of interaction. But the main idea is obviously with the passenger up front. And because you're going at more of a speed, it's you're going at sort of running pace.
Okay.
It means that we can do a much longer adventure in 1 hour with the elders than maybe edging out with a walking frame if they're lucky, or a wheelchair. Or indeed, if they are slightly more mobile, it comes down to time and staff to be able to take people out. So most people we see, it's their only outing, and probably 99% come out in their slippers. So we tuck them up and we go for wind and hair adventuring along both the seaside prom, around parks or around the local allotments, all of which just makes them feel much more part of the community, and they just get a lot of feedback from people. Yesterday we met a school group, they were all waving, Bet was doing her best royal wave back. we met quite a few dogs. We get a little bit competitive between our two bikes when our pilots go out together. We're like, okay, who can get the cuddliest dog on board their bike first? Moira won that yesterday with a little dog called Billy, who was 10 months, totally adorable. You get lots of interaction like that, which is great fun.
Yeah, kind of probably something that a lot of us would take for granted, and something that they just don't experience so much anymore because they're inside so much.
Absolutely. Mm. And what we often find is people haven't been on a bike for maybe 60 years.
Goodness.
And that feeling of being on a bike is something quite extraordinary, that, like you say, if you haven't had it for a while, you kind of forget, but you maybe take for granted. But it is a real sense of freedom that's very different to being in a wheelchair, for example. So one of our very first passengers, Shirley, we took out, said, you know, when I go out in my wheelchair, nobody looks at me. Everybody very Britishly casts their eyes away.
I was going to say, it's a very different experience, isn't it? You think, oh,
and
better.
So, you become the centre of attention.
Right.
And people naturally come up to you. And, when we introduce our pilots, all volunteers, when they introduce our passengers and say, oh, you know, would you like to come and meet our VIPs, our very important passengers? You know, this is Joan, she's a mere 91, and this is Marjorie, she's just 102. And then, you know, they'll immediately be wowed, because actually many people don't meet people in their 90s very often. So that's a really lovely side to it.
How many care homes are you affiliated with now?
Well, so we currently support 8. We have worked with around 13. And we take weekly rides, sometimes both bikes, sometimes one bike, depending on the size of the care home. And we also work with Millview Mental Health Hospital, and we take out their dementia ward residents as well, many of whom haven't been outside at all for a number of months. And that can be the same in care homes too, because of ill health, because maybe they've been recovering from a fall, change in medication, things like that. So we'll often have people who haven't been outside for a long time, as well as people who come out with us very regularly. And now that we've been going for just 2 years, we've got to know a number of families, friends, children of our participants, and a lot of the care homes include us in their kind of regular parties. So we get to know them and become part of the family in the care home, which all helps with familiarity as well for those living with dementia.
What effects do you see it have on the people that you take out on the bikes?
Well, that's really the best part, so I'm glad you asked that. Mm-hmm. It's really quite extraordinary. I think when we first started out, we were a bit anxious to think, you know, can we really achieve all of these things? But the reality is, because of the fresh air, because of the level of stimulation of just simply being outside and moving along at a pace and interacting with people, having the wind in your hair, feeling the elements, seeing and touching and smelling things along the way, whether that's at the allotment or the sea air, has an incredible effect on people's mood. So you see that instantly. But what we also see and hear a lot, and again, because we've built relationships over the last couple of years from the care homes and their family members, is that people sleep better. And if people are sleeping better, they're going to be less agitated, particularly for people living with dementia, who can really suffer from, you know, anxious mood, often depression, all sorts of effects are on their day-to-day well-being, if you like. And what we then see is they, you know, they're more likely to eat their lunch because they've been out and been stimulated and had the fresh air and, you know, feel exercised and stimulated. And then, you know, that then leads to them being calmer, therefore able to participate perhaps in some activities later in the day, whereas they might think, well, so we're not claiming miracles by any means. What we can see is the joy that it brings, and particularly with dementia.
Is it an experience that they remember week to week?
Yes.
Yeah, it is.
Not always, and of course that's very individual. But quite often, one of the most touching things is, of course, when they do remember you. But equally, it's not necessarily about being remembered, it's about when they say at the end of the ride, perhaps they've maybe even been quite quiet on the ride. So some people be very chatty, some people aren't able to speak. But it's their communication, their non-verbal communication with you at the end of the ride, as well as if they can and do say thank you and tell you how much they enjoyed it. That is just, as the pilots will say, you know, it's just the icing on the cake.
That's, I bet. Yeah, I bet it's a wonderful feeling.
So they get as much out of it, well-being and cheer-wise, as the participants, for sure. And
I was going to say, that's how this stuff works, isn't it? It is always mutually beneficial to bring everyone together and to experience these things collectively.
It's been quite surprising. Yeah, exactly. The collective has been quite surprising in terms of the reaction from the public, which has just been extraordinary. You know, we really do feel part of the community.
It's one of those things, isn't it? It's sad that we can't do this just naturally anyway, without the presence of a bike in between the two things, you know.
I think that's a very interesting point, because I often think when I'm cycling around with them, I think, well, you know, in their day when they were out on their own bicycles a lot, they would stop and chat and they would say hello, and they, you know, so since I've been involved with this organisation, I've been on my way to whatever I'm doing on foot other times, I've started saying hello to people more and saying good morning in a way that, you know, actually my generation, I'm 44, haven't really always had as part of the fabric of society and community.
Only in the countryside, it seems, when you go for a walk, people will say hello, but it doesn't really happen anywhere else, does it?
No, that's very true.
Yeah, especially in the south.
In fact, Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm from the north, and I do feel that as well. And that's really interesting on the seafront prom, because again, there's a lot more holiday sort of vibe there, whether you live here or not. But all summer we do notice we get a lot of hellos. And then when it thins out, we rely on the dog walkers, who are lovely as well, because they'll always stop and chat, because the dog will be investigating the wheels and the people.
Right.
And so, yeah, we do rely on people to do that. And it's really a great relief when they do. And I think it's also a really nice invitation to the rest of the community, because it is a little bit interesting and exciting. And we literally invite them in. So we teach our pilots, and don't hold back, do wave and say hello. Would you like to come and say hello? And we invite people over. And they immediately take up that invitation. But it's not having that sort of constant invitation, isn't it?
Well, maybe it's projects like this that just start to make that change and make the difference. You know, if you started doing it by being involved, then maybe someone else who stopped to have a chat with you will do it too. So you never know, do you? You don't really know.
Yeah, exactly.
You never know the knock-on effect you're having, ever.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what we have found, delightfully, is that despite being a terribly small charity, you know, because we're visible with the bikes, particularly if your daily habits happen to be around the areas where our routes are, people have got used to seeing us and do treat us a bit like part of the family, because they know that they're invited in and that, you know, they are as much part of it as we are.
It works on so many levels, doesn't it? Because you've got the experience of being outside with the wind in your face, nature, and then you've got the connection with your community, you've got the interaction with other people, and you've got the continuation of people coming in that you become familiar with, so you're developing relationships as well. So it's so many layers of goodness within one project.
The intergenerational aspect is lovely, but both for the pilots and for those we meet out and about, just don't get attached. You know, we do know that the nature is that. The reality is that when you've got a 102-year-old, that she probably isn't going to be with you forever. But what we do is make sure we have a jolly nice time while we can. And that's what's so lovely is we've had a couple of in-memory donations this year. We have lost a couple of our longest-term passengers. And it's been really fantastic to have the feedback and just the joy from their families. Who've instantly contacted us to let us know and thank us. And it's really great to know that, you know, we went to a couple of funerals recently, and, you know, one was 87, one was 102. And at both of them, they took the trouble to mention us. And I just thought, these people have had extraordinary lives. You know, Marjorie was 102. She was a teacher in Brighton all her life. She belonged to the generation where she had to choose between career or marriage. And she chose teaching. And, you know, thousands of children in Brighton who grew up, you know, were part of that choice for her. And she went with them to Leicester when they were evacuated. You know, she had an extraordinary life.
Wow.
She did so much for community. And yet, you know, we were still of significance in her last, only her last year she was with us. And it's just amazing to think that people's worlds, having done so much in their lives, shrink to such a small extent that such a small thing as us can be so significant. And that, I think, is where the real, you know, when you do get attached to people and you do lose them, they do need to die, you can be really glad in a different way to when it's your own family, that you were part of making something much better for them.
Such a good project. I love it. I mean, yeah, I think it's so heartbreaking how many older people are in homes and don't get to go outside really very much at all anymore. So this project, and I love the way she calls them elders and not elderly people. I feel like that's like a really important distinction. And the wind in the hair adventures, and on the pictures that you can see online on their website, which is pedalpeople.org.uk, these just joyful, gleeful faces of these people on the bikes. It's one of those things that you just hope it goes nationwide and is everywhere. And thank the Lord for people like her who have the volition and the energy to get those projects off the ground. Someone else who's a lot like that actually is the next interview, and she is Jo from the Project Grow, who have been on before about 18 months ago when I went out with them over at Saddlescombe Farm, but some new developments have happened for them, so I just wanted to catch up and see what that was about and how they're getting on. But first we're going to have a song. Of course it's going to be bicycle themed. It's not Queen though. I bet you thought it was going to be Queen. It's not. It's French, and it's called A Bicyclette. or a bicyclette. And I love it.
Dans les champs chantaient les grillons, le soleil dardait ses rayons de bicyclette. Elle voulait que je chante un brin, mais à cela j'ai mis un frein de bicyclette. Près d'un tournant, il y avait un bois où l'on se dirige à ma foi, à bicyclette. Mais comme elle roulait près de moi, voilà qu'elle me fait presque à mi-voix, à bicyclette.
I mean, I've got absolutely no idea what he's saying, but I assume it's something along the lines of I really like my bike. That's actually in my playlist on my phone. Little insight there into the kind of music that I enjoy. Okay, so next up we have Joe Wren, who is the director and course leader at Grow. Some of you may remember that they were on about 18 months ago and on the Wellbeing show. It's had such a wonderful response, and so I thought it'd be nice to catch up with her and see what they were up to and how it's all going. And I knew also that there was a new arm to the project that was just about to start. So here is Joe just giving us a bit of a recap as to what the project Grow actually is, and then the exciting things that are coming up for them.
Grow's a local charity that works mainly with people with mental health issues, using nature connection for well-being. So we work with people with experience of depression, anxiety and other mental health issues out on the South Downs, usually at Saddlescombe Farm, and kind of connect people in with nature through a range of different activities so that they can find something that makes them feel better, improves their health, and also that inspires them to carry on using nature as a resource that's always there to kind of improve and maintain their well-being.
How long have you been doing that for now?
Since 2011. We ran our first group in 2011 up at Saddlescombe Farm.
Wow, quite so, a while.
Maths.
8 years.
Eight and a half years. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Have you seen within that time quite a lot of change in the zeitgeist, I guess, you know, in society generally? When you first started, was it kind of an unusual thing to do? Was it a bit on the fringes of?
It really was. Yeah. It felt like we caught it in 2011 on a wave. Do you see what I mean? Kind of ahead of the curve, really. And it felt like this was something that some people were starting to talk about, but really right on the fringes. And so I think we were extremely lucky when we started at that time, because definitely in the last sort of 8 years or so, there's been a real upsurge, and it's great that it's happening. But a real upsurge in people understanding how helpful nature can be, and in the evidence that people are collecting of it, and in the number of different projects that are introducing people to nature and as a way of kind of managing well-being. Brighton is, there are so many different projects in Brighton that do similar things in different ways, but similar things. And amazingly enough, I think, you know, all of us are finding people, you know, to take part in them, because the need is so great out there. So but it definitely does feel like there's been a big swell.
I mean, to the point where it's being prescribed by GPs now.
Starting to be.
Yeah, isn't that? I think that's wonderful. Social
Which
prescribing.
Is quite amazing. Yeah.
What a shift.
Definitely. And I mean, you know, how incredible is that people start prescribing nature, because it has no side effects, you know, and it doesn't cost anything. It's great, you know, so long may it continue.
Yeah. So what is happening for Grow now? Because you've been going for this, going for 8 years, but a new horizon has arrived.
A new horizon indeed. Yeah. I mean, we've been working with the National Trust, in partnership with the National Trust at Saddlescombe Farm, you know, on a really local basis for the last 8 years. And then gradually over the last couple of years, people sort of higher up in the National Trust have started to take an interest in what we do, and been listening to the results, you know, from some of the people that have been through the project, gradually through that, the National Trust have been pricking up their ears and really seeing what we're doing and understanding that, that it's something that really works.
It's a real story of just a very small group now having what could be a national impact. So it's always worth it.
Don't say that, I get too excited.
Could be. I put a caveat in there.
It could be.
But to have a massive organisation like the National Trust to prick up their ears and pay attention to something that that you and one other person dreamt up, I think it's just such testament to the fact that we can make a difference on a bigger scale when we just do something that seems quite small.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's what's so exciting about this. And, I think for us, what it shows us is, we have a model that really works. And what we're trying to see now is actually, can it work somewhere else? And if it can work somewhere else, how do we do that? And then if it does work somewhere else, then it potentially, as you say, can be extended out.
So where is this somewhere else? Where are you going to do it next?
So the somewhere else, So the somewhere else that we're talking about is a place called Standon House, which is over near East Grinstead.
I love it there. It's actually it's so great. It's one of my favourite National Trusts.
I didn't really know Standon House that much, so I went home and kind of, Googled it, and I'd never been there. And then saw it as an arts and craft house and was, doubly excited. and I'd never been over there until just a couple of probably 3 or 4 months ago, actually. And oh god, it's beautiful. And the house, because my worry was that they were, some National Trust houses can have that kind of quite formal air about them, and
very managed.
And I was a little bit worried about a little bit worried about whether it might be like that, but the house itself is gorgeous.
It was decorated by William Morris, wasn't it?
And I don't know if you've been over there while they've had the William Morris exhibition on there, but the William Morris exhibition is all about taking inspiration from nature. So that was that felt like a really nice little difference with this place.
Yeah,
it might make it something quite different.
My camping mug is a William Morris print.
Really?
Yeah. Love it.
Nice.
Which I got from there, actually. So
then they've got the most amazing grounds, and they've got a kitchen garden which is just beautiful, and the formal gardens, and then around it this really lovely woodland, which is really easily accessible, and then beyond that the most incredible wheeled countryside. So I went to visit it and came back just completely buzzing that it seemed like a really good place. And the National Trust, I think, are recognizing this, that they have a bit of a problem, or not a problem, but they have some issues around who their main sort of client base is, or the people that visit their properties, and the fact that actually they want to be welcoming everyone. But there are some barriers to that, I think. And there are some barriers around perceptions, and there are some barriers around costs. So I think what they're really keen to do, and that's why they wanted to get in touch with us, and I have to say, not just us, they're working with some other groups, sort of nationally as well, is that they're recognizing they have some really beautiful spaces and places that don't necessarily easily welcome people in from different, different groups.
Yeah, different demographics, different social backgrounds.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
What will you be doing there?
So we'll be running one of our Grow Seasons, which is an 8-week group of sort of one full day a week for 8 weeks. It'll be starting on the 29th of October through to the 17th of December. Mm. We'll be putting together a kind of program of different activities that connect people in with the place, in with the woodlands, in doing some gardening, doing some conservation work. And what I'm really hoping is that we get some time as well to do something perhaps a little bit creative, in keeping with the William Morris tradition of being inspired by nature and creating and taking the outdoors in, especially I think given the the time of the year that we'll be doing it. You know, I'm hoping that we can do some stuff in the house as well.
Yeah, you may need to have a couple of indoor activities up here.
Yeah, I'm hoping. Looking out of my window at the moment with the rain lashing down.
Oh,
maybe we should have done a summer season there. But sometimes people find it really much harder to get out in the winter. And probably need to get out more in the winter if you're struggling with your mental health. So actually, although it doesn't feel like a, you know, it's the easiest thing sometimes. It's sometimes the most helpful thing to be outside, battling with the elements. You know, because you can be, you know, from the experience that we've had over the last sort of 8 years, you know, people's mental health really declines quite a lot in the winter, and it's easy to get outside in the summer when the sun's shining, but it's not so easy when it's a bit darker and a bit greyer. So I'm hoping that this will encourage people to get outdoors and feel the rain on their face. And
yeah, I think
feel how it feels.
For me, such a mindset around good and bad weather. And if you can change that and just think, no, it's just weather, whatever it is, and everything,
you're so right.
It's all, you can engage with all of it in different ways, and it doesn't have to be bad. Sometimes the rain on your face, I've woken up outside before in a bivy bag and it's been raining, and the feeling of the rain waking me up is so glorious. I love it. And it's just,
absolutely,
you know,
we've had times out on Grow before where we've been sitting under a shelter and it'd be absolutely hammering it down and then trying to go for a walk and getting, you know, soaked through to your pants and stuff like that. And those are the times actually that people, you know, they just love.
Exactly. You know, and it's fun.
Their faces come alive. Because it's fun. And when you get through it, you feel like you've like got through something.
Yeah,
really,
it's a bonding experience.
Survived.
Yeah, exactly. And we're not going to stay damp forever. We're all pretty fortunate in that we can got somewhere dry and warm to go. You know, it's never going to be.
We're not going to dissolve, are we?
Well, exactly. No, exactly. Yeah.
Our skin's waterproof, so it's all good, really. Yeah.
That was Jo Wren there. How great that they are working now with the National Trust. And the National Trust have really seen the need for projects like hers. And I wish them all the luck in the world, and I hope it goes really well. That theme of the wrong weather crops up a couple of times in these interviews for me. I think probably because we've just actually had some rain, and it's felt quite exciting because it's been a while since there's been rain. So If we'd have done that interview in a couple of weeks after Solid Rain, I probably would be saying, God, yeah, the wrong weather is very much definitely a thing. You can find out more about them at growingwellbeing.org.uk. Okay, let's have a song, and then we're going to be hearing from our final guest, Rowena Garrett. But first, it's Goji Berry Sunset by Jealous of the Birds.
Goji Berry Sunset, that's how it all started. Sitting on the lakeside, talking about old time. Arms laced with red thread, forget the things that I said. Quote a line from Tennyson, poetry is medicine. Your name fizzes on my tongue. Your name, it fizzes on my tongue. Damn that name.
That was Jealous of the Birds. Short but oh so very sweet, that one. You're listening to Growing Wild on Radio Reverb with me, Charlotte Petz. Next up, we have Rowena Garrett. Now, she was very hardy in meeting up for this interview because we met. It was such a windy, blustery, rainy morning. And I, you know, when sometimes you look at the weather app and it says 80%, 82% chance of rain, you plan your day around that, especially as a gardener. And sometimes you think, oh, well, maybe I'll move that work to there and diddler. And then actually it's just bright and sunny all day, and it was a total lie, and the app lied to you. So I've learned not to rely on those apps and just going out and just seeing what happens anyway. And maybe just looking at in the sky, you know, that old chestnut. It didn't work out on this morning. So we very much met up in, it was quite damp. And I thought, we'll go to the beach. So it was a bit windy. The sea is in the background. It's very atmospheric. And we had these two little camping chairs just tucked in around the corner using a closed up cafe as shelter from the wind, covered up in our waterproofs. So just setting the scene for you there. And I wanted to find out a little bit more about the sort of work that Rowena did, because The last two interviews have been projects very much for groups in ways that they can engage with nature and people who are struggling in very different ways. And so I just wanted to see what people who work more on a one-to-one basis did. This kind of ecotherapy realm has grown enormously recently, and this feeling that connecting with nature can benefit our well-being and our mental health and all of the things so well, and how do you incorporate that into a therapeutic realm? And it just seems to be an area that, yeah, like I said, is just growing. So I've seen that Rowena is working in that field, and she's quite local to me, so I wanted to find out more about the ways in which she worked and how she used the wonder of nature in helping people through times of struggle.
The way that I work is with, as you say, a strong nature connection and body connection, and I see those two things as inextricably linked. So some of the work that I do coaching with people is more what you might immediately think of in that kind of work. I do it in a very organic, intuitive way. A lot of my work is about people ultimately knowing what they need, knowing what they want to achieve, and a lot of it is about self-trust and really connecting with your values and bringing what you want into fruition in alignment with that. It's about being in alignment, and I think nature has so much to teach us around that. So sometimes it is about explicit connection with nature, for example the changes in the seasons and the shifts in energy that come with that, the way that we can understand our own work and our own lives, which really of course is one and the same thing. And I think we live in a world where we've separated from that so much, particularly, you know, in this first industrialised and post-industrial age, that the more we can appreciate how these things impact on us and how we sit within it, we can also then really connect with ourselves and trust ourselves within that space.
Okay, so what sort of things... That is broad, isn't it? Because so how would you narrow that down? You hear a lot of advice sometimes just sitting and being outside, like we are today, despite the rain. Because I'm a great believer in the weather not being bad. It's just our interpretation of the weather. And sometimes just letting things come to you, you know, maybe a bird will come and sit next to you. And that can be just a really nice little connecting thing. What sort of things do you do?
Some of the work that we do is explicitly about nature connection, and actually some of it is, as you say, about sitting and being. And a lot of work that's done in ecotherapy and also within coaching in different ways, it's about holding the space, about creating the space for people to explore. And then some of it is also about it's a space that's really conducive for restoration and for reflection and for looking forwards as well. So, you know, from decades ago when Kaplan and Kaplan started thinking about like attention restoration therapy and, you know, all of these things that have now been explored in so much depth in terms of the impact that nature has upon our minds and upon our beings. I think a lot of the exploration that is part of the coaching experience, sitting out and being in nature is just... It works so beautifully for those kind of practices.
What sort of things do you see happening with your clients? What sort of changes do you see?
A lot of the changes I see are about self-trust, you know, trust increasing in our own intuition, changes in having clarity in terms of direction.
That'd be nice.
Well, wouldn't it?
I want some of that.
And when I say clarity, I mean that in a... not because there is a linear path, because we know that there isn't one. And actually, that is one of the big things that I personally take from being out in nature and from and that I work with people on, is that the road is, the path is not linear, but you know it's bumpy and it has all of the weather, all of the elements. And that's why sitting out here in this, you know, this really elemental space, you know, it's such a... There are so many metaphors to be drawn from nature, aren't there? You know, that we can work with. So that's certainly part of the conversation that we have. And then also the physicality of it. You know, if you're sat peacefully under a tree, you'll be having a very different experience to if we get up and we walk. You know, lots of us will have some of our best ideas when we're out on the hill and we're marching along and the wind is blowing and the rain, and they might not be good ideas 3 hours later.
Lovely to have them at the time.
But yeah, but they can fly in and fly out of our heads, and we choose which ones we pick. And so when I work one-to-one, it's also about that. We can change the pace. We can even change direction, like literally, in terms of how we're walking. And that can help to shift in terms of perhaps perspective and the way we're doing things.
So it's almost, it sounds like it might just help you know the next step. It's not about seeing the whole picture laid out in front of you, but it might just slow you down enough to just think, oh, I think this is my next step. Mm-hmm. Yeah, quite a gentle process, really.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think when we connect with ourselves and our values and our core understanding, actually we don't need to initially know the how. We we want to have a little idea of the what and how that sits with us, and also with our sense of where we are within the world. And then the how, we can figure that out along the way, you know, and a lot of the time we'll fall over and then get back up again as we figure it out.
Over and over and over. Yeah. Hello, life. Yeah. And how did you come to this work?
Yeah, I came to this work, as I think a lot of people do within this field, through my own experiences. So I come from an education and a volunteer coordination background here and overseas. And then connection and experience with nature has always been integral to my own personal experiences. I feel very fortunate that from a child that was part of my experience. I think it's been much more explicit in perhaps the last 5 years as I've really chosen to go on a much greater sort of self-exploration and shift. My mental health has been a big part of that, so being outside has been part of my work with anxiety, with depression, and also with shifting how I work and how I see myself in the world, really. So you know, a couple of years ago, for example, I spent some time off work and I went and camped in the woods. You know, it was March and I was the only one in this campsite. It was glorious and cold. There was a massive fire. But that really elemental experience and was just so powerful. And then in that same year, 3 weeks of solo walking and camping on the Southwest Coast Path, which I was really lucky to listen to the interview with Raina Wynn, which I read her book, I read afterwards actually, and loved it.
Sometimes we can go out on these adventures and expect a lot from them. It depends what mindset you go out on, doesn't it? What happened for you? 3 weeks is a long time. I imagine there's a lot of ups and downs within that.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, literally, because
it's so hard.
It's really hard.
It's a tough path. We're not talking a flat route round the edge of the country here.
No,
it's epic.
And I loved that. But I hear what you're saying in terms of sort of trying to go in with intention, but without too much expectation. And I had originally sort of going somewhere really wild. And then this fitted with where I was at that point. And for me,
there's an optimistic ice cream van somewhere in the background. I love it. I love the British spirit in the windiest of weather.
I can see a little bit of blue sky. It's might be in my mind's eye, but it's peeking through. It was intentionally solo, and it is that there is that element of there is no escaping yourself when you are there. And it's learning to be with yourself and be with yourself comfortably. I love the physicality of it, the challenge of that. I absolutely love it, and the very much, you know, the in the moment experiences that you have. I love standing on the edges of cliffs, and I stood there with, you know, rain like belting in off the sea, and I shouted and rah, not necessarily with anger sometimes, but also just with, I guess, like with life, with vitality.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because we keep all of that so held, you know. We're so contained in our contained little cars and our contained little houses and offices and whatever, and it's all in you all of the time. And yeah, it's surprising and beautiful when you get the space to just allow it out, just to get it. And you're not mad for doing it. And that's been the label. We've got to keep it all in, otherwise you might look a bit mad.
Yeah.
It makes you mad by not letting it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really empathise with that, absolutely. And a lot of my work is around sort of people shaping their own narrative and using their voice in a clear and confident way. And that's been a big part of my own work within myself. And yeah, when we're on those cliffs and when we're, you know, when we're putting in that real physical effort, it can really help us to explore that. And it's a bit of bravery as well. It was my first ever solo wild camp that I did there.
Wow.
And I chose this spot. I mean, I was really scared.
Mm.
I didn't do it solely because I felt comfortable. I did it because I wanted to be out there and experience it, and because I wanted to scare myself a little bit and to be in that.
Mm.
And I think the experiences that we can have outdoors as well, you know, like that, you know, we can carry, can't we, into other parts of our lives. I really believe in that.
Yeah.
Very strongly.
Yeah,
so that was a big part of the experience. And I did text my friend the coordinates of where I was. I sent her a message saying, these mean nothing to you, but this is what you can give to the police if I haven't texted you by 8 a.m. tomorrow.
Yeah, but did you find there are elements of danger? Of course there are, but 99% of that is just in our minds. We don't allow these challenges, we don't have them, we don't know what strength we have because we won't put ourselves in that situation.
Yeah, absolutely. Putting yourself just within that sphere of fear and excitement at the same time is really powerful.
And I find, even though I've done it a few times now, every time I do it again, I'll still get the, you know, the same fears will come back. Oh yeah, hi guys, you know. Yeah, it's fascinating. Our brains are fascinating. It's not as if you can do something once and feel like forevermore it's fine, because it just doesn't work like that. It comes back over and over again. And I think that's, yeah, like you say, that's such a lesson in life as well.
I think part of understanding fear is understanding why it's there, and understanding that it's natural, that it's there to protect us. And we know this, don't we, that, you know, what would have been our fear of actual death has, for most of us, mostly now in our world, translated into a fear of social death, really. And so many of the things that make us afraid, and for a lot of us can bring up anxiety, if we can understand why it's there, and at the same time say, I can be with you in that fear, I understand why you're there for us, for me, but thank you, I don't need you, I'm going to continue anyway.
Maybe someone that's heard this and they think this makes sense to me, is there any one thing that they could do now that would be just a helpful step? You know, because it can all seem a bit big, it's a bit overwhelming, it's like, oh gosh, I'm going to have to restructure everything, and that is all quite big. What one small thing could they do?
Take a breath, change how you're standing. If you're slouched over, stand up, be in your body, and if you can, step outside, and do that on a daily basis. Yeah. And take 90 seconds or 2 minutes to be in yourself, and be with your breath. And don't think that we have to change everything, or indeed anything, if we don't want to. But explore and be kind.
How many people listening to that end bit did all of those things? Because I just did, sitting in my chair. I realised I was all hunched up, not breathing very well. So I took a breath and sat up. And yeah, it can just be that simple. We had such a long chat. That was a 40-minute, hour-long, something long. It was a long chat. And there was a lot in there that I just couldn't fit in. But she went on to talk about how we should work more with the seasons and the rhythms of that, and how we are much more in sync with it than we think. And our routines these days just block that out. You know, we work the same hours through summer, through winter, and wonder why our energy levels are so affected. So it's all It's all pretty good stuff, I think. And you can find out more about her work on her website, which is rowantreecoaching.com. And I don't intentionally mean for every one of my interviews recently to be about the South West Coast Path. I'm not getting paid by them or anything. But it seems, I think maybe the last three shows that's just come up. Make of that as you will. Maybe everyone's supposed to go and walk it. I don't know. But it is beautiful. It seems to be a bit of a theme where it's where people gravitate to go and walk and sort out some things in their minds. Well, we've reached the end of the show. Thank you to all those who are part of the show. Please do find out more about all of those projects if you are interested. It's pedalpeople.org.uk, growingwellbeing.org.uk, and then Rowena's on rowantreecoaching.com. You can get in touch with me via many different ways, mainly Instagram, which is at growingwildfm, Twitter, but I so rarely use it because it is like opening the door into a lot of people shouting and you kind of, you know, hello, sorry, can I, hi, never mind. And then you just shut the door again because they can just get on with it, frankly. But occasionally I pop up on there. And also you can email growingwildreverb@gmail.com. I'm going to play you out with Where Do You Go To, My Lovely by Peter Sade. Thank you for listening. Go well. I'll hopefully be back next month.
Your clothes are all made by Balmain, and there's diamonds and pearls in your hair. Yes, there are. You live in a fancy apartment off the boulevard Saint-Michel, where you keep your Rolling Stones records and a friend of Sacha Distel. Yes, you do. But where do you go to, my lovely, when you're alone in your bed? Tell me the thoughts that surround you. I want to look inside your head. Yes, I do.